Hello, I'm Phil Layton, the CEO and founder of Pi Energy. Welcome to the Pi Energy podcast, where we talk with people who work in the clean tech world trying to find solutions that are innovative and can transform the world for the better, whether they're technical, educational, or provide a way for you to navigate the world in a more sustainable way. Today, I'm interviewing James Regulinski, one of the co-founders of the Carbon Collective. They have created a platform for investing, both as an individual or for a company-sponsored 401k that takes the guesswork out of investing by allocating funds to companies that are climate-focused and forward-thinking. James's background is in engineering, and he has an extensive experience in the laboratory, working on a multitude of projects from robotics, solar, water quality, agriculture, and more. He started the Carbon Collective in 2020 because, in his words, investing is believing in something, and this allows people to easily help make the future the way they want to see it. All right. Hey, James, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, Phil. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's really exciting. The Carbon Collective, that's a really interesting concept. Can you just give a little brief description of that and what brought you to creating it?
Yeah, so Carbon Collective is an online-only investment advisor that helps people divest their money from fossil fuels and invest it in actual climate change solutions. And this started because when Zach and myself, Zach's my co-founder, we were looking for some way to invest our money in a way that felt aligned with the world we wanted to see built. We didn't see anything. There was a lot of greenwashing out there. There's a lot of unclear reasons for why investing in so-called ESG funds would create positive impact. And we wanted to see something that was a little more proactive. We had read Project Drawdown, which is a great book that lays out a model for how we get to a point where we're removing more CO2 from the atmosphere than we're releasing every year. And that was really the inspiration for the kinds of investments that we were making. So created a bit of a fund where you can invest across the board in those types of technologies.
And these are public companies or private? What type of mix do you have?
Right now, we're only dealing in publicly traded securities for a whole host of reasons, but we understand that there are a bunch of companies that are either not yet public or will never go public because they're too small or do something that's not well fitted for the public markets. And we think those need funding just as much, if not more. And so our long-term goal is to be able to offer those to investors in ways that make sense with their other financial goals.
And what type of technologies are you focusing on? What type of renewable?
So again, going back to Project Drawdown, they listed a whole bunch of sectors that you needed to be, that we need to be investing more in if we're going to stay below that 1.5C. So we don't just invest in renewables. Now, renewables are incredibly important, but there's both supporting technology to that. What about the power transmission infrastructure, the batteries, et cetera? But we also invest in clean transportation and in meat alternatives and in the closed loop economy. So all of these different fronts in where we can reduce the amount of carbon emission dramatically by changing by what's available.
How do you evaluate the companies? Do you do a deep dive? You do kind of how is that?
So for our collection of companies right now, we're not actually making a call on which companies are the best. Now, I am sure there are folks who are doing that really well, but we wanted to expose people to all of the companies within a solution set. So let's take inverters or solar panels. Now, as you know, there are solar panels that are far better than others. And there are companies that could be far better at manufacturing those. There's a whole bunch of factors in which a company could be better or worse. So instead of us trying to tell you which one it is, we'll put them all the publicly traded ones that get most of their revenue from that technology, from that solution space, and not from, say, they make solar panels, but 90% of their revenue comes from burning fossil fuels or building gas turbines. That wouldn't be really supporting that solution. So if it makes most of its revenue from that climate change solution, then it would make it onto our list. Now, there are a couple other criteria that we want to make sure it hits, but that's sort of the baseline. It's really for folks who want to be in that solution space as a whole and not in picking individual companies.
So I'm focused on clean tech, renewable technologies, and then specifically solar. What of the technologies that you have been following, which ones are the most exciting, do you think, and has the most potential?
So first, I need to give the disclaimer. I am not making investment recommendations.
Yeah.
I'm not telling you right now how you should invest your money. However, we see a lot of things that are really exciting, particularly on the sustainability front. I'm going to start tangentially. So I see, and I know with your interest in solar, that's where you really want me to go.
Yeah.
But I've been tracking ways in which we, to support solar, as we know, there's only 8 hours of solar in a day. You can either increase the time at which you have sun by transmitting the power to where it's needed geographically. So you have a solar plant in Arizona sending power back to the East Coast and vice versa, or you can store it. And so I'm very interested in the storage technologies I've been seeing come on the market, or not yet be on the market, as we start to hear them talked about. And these are everything from how do we get the resources? So everyone's talking about lithium ion batteries, but we don't have enough capacity in getting lithium to meet the demand. So or can we do that in a more interesting or sustainable way?
Or the cobalt.
That's a really big one that's been.
I know the LiPo ones are really, the lithium iron phosphate ones don't have that. So they're, you know, non-toxic and they have.
So I think in novel ways of finding and less environmentally detrimental ways of finding and extracting those kind of minerals has been really interesting to me. The exploration into iron and aluminum batteries, which we started to see come out, abundance of both of those resources, if you could make a meaningful battery in that way, that could unlock a lot of grid scale storage. Now they're going to be too heavy for things like electric vehicles per se, but we need a mix of technologies when we're talking about any of these solutions.
Yeah. The other one that's kind of interesting is using the existing infrastructure where you have more of a time valuation associated with the electricity and being able to use your electric vehicle to charge the grid when you have extra. You have all this capacity in these cars and be able to go back and forth and also provide backup power to houses. So kind of an integrated microgrids all over using everybody's electric vehicle.
We're starting to see a lot more companies look at how do you interface all of this. So we're going to be, as we go to deep electrification, we're going to be, which is, by the way, a key part of a lot of the models of how we stay at a reasonable temperature is electric appliances and vehicles, et cetera, are a lot more efficient. And so you get a lot of gains just by switching over to that. So as we have more electric vehicles and ranges and so forth, we're going to be, we'll need more power, but we'll also have more ability to respond to different demands. Now, this could happen in your car in terms of you now have this big battery, which you can power your home or smooth out the grid, provide microservices. So that could be really fast smoothing, or it could be longer term, like hour long demand response. But you also have things like, when do you turn on your hot water heater? Can you thermally, that's a battery in itself. You're storing thermal energy there. When do you, you know, use other appliances in your house? And coordinating all of that could smooth out a lot of the variability that people are concerned about, particularly with the number of renewables that we're talking about bringing onto the grid. So really exciting when the companies that are coming out that are building those interconnected technologies.
Broader, what do you think? I mean, there's a lot of things you can do. There's, you have the technology, you have ways of minimizing how much CO2 you're doing, and then you have like insulation. And what do you see as, I know your mix in your investment portfolio, where do you see a mix of that, a third, or you have any suggestions on how that balances out?
I mean, I'm at this point, I'm a believer in all roads that we can't take. As you were discussing, using energy more wisely is incredibly valuable. There's a psychological consideration that you have to take into account when you talk about using less. People respond poorly to
good point.
Scarcity mentality. Mm-hmm. And while I think that there's a lot to be gained from knowing the limits of your wants and in your life deciding how much you need and not saying, oh, I need more and more and more and more. Like, I think there is a peace and a satisfaction in life that can come from that. Telling people to use less power, to drive less, to travel less, to see their friends less, to drink less, to eat less, that kind of prescriptive mentality, A, isn't going to change minds. And B, we have a stubbornness built into us, into our society, that I think is going to hit up against the wall when we get there. So while we invest in companies that are building building automation and insulation technologies, better glass, smart glass, these things that will reduce the amount of energy buildings need, and there's an economic benefit as well as an environmental benefit to doing those, I think that we will not reduce our way out of the climate crisis. We also need to transition how we do things. So this is why I would not put a third of all of my eggs just in the reduction basket.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is important. There's a lot of interest in storage. So that's part of the equation, but you need to have the power generated that matches with that. So one of the things you brought up is you only have sunlight 8 hours a day, and sometimes you have cloudy days. So you need a lot of storage, but at the same time, you need to match it with a lot of generation that then goes into that storage.
And this is why I don't think we are going to see one technology dominate and be our whole solution. There could be a magic. I'm not a nuclear physicist. I can't tell you that fusion is not just around the corner, and that we could build those plants and power the whole world from one plant and everyone was happy. However, what I have seen as being a more likely solution is a mixture of different technologies playing together. And this goes back to like the question of interconnected devices. When you have the ability to store and use and have demand response that matches different fluctuations, you can merge a whole lot more types of generation. So wind and solar and nuclear and biofuels and geothermal. I haven't seen a lot of wave technologies out there that are done like really meaningful projects, but that could factor into all of this. And when all of those are playing together, a way for them to work in concert and have our industry respond better to how we manufacture, how we use that energy intelligently could make a noisy mix, something that's actually really effective for us.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's important is note is that you have resiliency. When you have a microgrid, lots of generation, you don't have one power plant dragging the whole grid down. So you have lots of different microgrids, lots of different sources of power, and the ability to isolate the different regions. And then when you have fires and some of these other conditions that are across the whole, not only the country, but the globe, but they're all different and unique. But having those micro sources of power and storage gives a lot more resiliency, and it's much harder to bring that down.
I think that's dead on. And as we talk about, we have a fairly hopeful outlook for solving the climate crisis at Carbon Collective. But even in the best case scenarios, we're already seeing disruptions to normal weather patterns and environmental disasters fairly regularly at this point, whether that be drought, fire, storms, et cetera, flooding. So resiliency is actually really critical. And a lot of our infrastructure was built with the assumption that our environment was going to be incredibly stable. Mm-hmm. You know, we're giving 50-year loans on power plants, assuming a whole bunch of things about the likelihood, the siting and zoning of those buildings that might not hold true. So when I'm very excited about the add-on benefits that come from reimagining how we deal with what has become a critical part of our lives. Like electricity is not a luxury resource right now.
It's anymore, right.
Yeah,
exactly. Like one of the things is the point is that like Lake Powell and some of the big hydroelectric projects, we're assuming that water supply would always be there. And you have these large projects that now they can't rely on it. So you really have to look at the more small scale you have, the more you can compensate without having to make up for some large project like you do from these hydroelectric ones.
And not to get too heady on the philosophical side, but there's definitely a tendency as we partake in state building to want to have oversight and control, but like our ability to oversee and control has its limits. And one of the cool things about sort of the computational revolution and the ability to have AIs and other more complex dealing with data is that we can not necessarily have that all be centralized and have to have that central control to be able to have complex systems interface. So I see that like in the past, it might be, oh, going small is being isolated and removed and disconnected. Whereas now we have the ability to go small and be dispersed and distributed and resilient and provide more benefit than the alternatives. Yeah. So that transition away from the centralized thinking to a distributed, everyone is a producer, everyone is a collaborator kind of thinking has been, I think, laying the groundwork for what we're seeing now in energy.
Yeah. And it's also interesting because it creates more of a spread the entrepreneurial capabilities across for more people, more opportunities. The other point I was going to, to what you're just saying is the supply chain challenges we have now, we really are starting to go to less of a all centralized production. You really need to look at having more distributed production because you don't know what you can rely on from one day to the next.
I don't remember the exact numbers, but I recall that the vast majority of silicon for all solar panels in China, which makes up the mass majority of silicon solar panels of the world, is controlled by just a few companies.
And now we're suffering the tariff. I heard people can't find enough solar panels to meet demand. So
we're seeing the fragility that comes with that. And when we talk about, and coming back to the technology that you're working on, when we talk about different types of renewable energy generation, we generally think of it's like, oh, solar versus wind, but it's also a question of what type, where can you site it? Yeah. I have a friend who's working on wind turbines you can put on buildings. Now that's a very different type of siting than the kind that needs to be offshore. And similarly, when you think about what is the underlying technology of your solar panels, where it can be manufactured, how distributed that can be, can add to the our ability as a planet to produce the amount of solar panels that we will need to meet the demand that we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key things is one, you need the materials. You have to think the whole end of life too, because at the end, when these things stop working, you have a whole nother problem disposing of them and transporting them, taking them down. So there's the materials, where can you manufacture it? What's the resiliency of that? Can you scale globally? So really the biggest impact are those that can be scaled. You may have a really cool technology, but like some of the lithium ion right now, if you're limited by cobalt or nickel, then you're going to have a challenge scaling to meet the demand to really make a difference.
And I think that's when we talk about why closed loop economy is in our portfolio as well as renewable energy. The question is, when it comes to a solar panel or a battery, what do you do next with it? Mm-hmm. Is it just more trash that we have in the world that is fouling up some public waterway? Or is it something that you can first downcycle and then recycle and bring back? And are we supporting like that look at the whole life? I mean, all of these resources are limited. There's a glass crunch right now. Unintended, but and glass is a big necessary part for the way we manufacture solar, right? And so we have it like competing, window glass and solar glass and automotive, all of these sources wanting these particular material, that's a problem. But similarly, if you can reuse the silicone, it becomes a lot more interesting than if it's an incredibly energy intense process that then gets thrown in the trash. And so I think that your question about end of life, is it toxic? Can it be reused? Yeah. Is one that in the face of when we talk about global warming can be pushed to the side at first glance, because we're like, well, how it gets disposed of is not a question about how much CO2. You can't see that in a CO2 number. But when we think about our planet as a closed loop system, and we want to be really effective at using all of the resources, because I think ultimately that will lead to more prosperity. If we do more with what we have, it will just as much lead to more prosperity if we just do more.
Yeah. And one of the other things we've been focusing on is use a lot less material than you have, less you have to recycle too. So, and it's easier to manufacture a lot if you're using a hundredth of the material, then it's much easier to provide your supply. So,
and to ship it and to mount it. We talked about, I think in our first conversation, we talked about this, where if you need to, it's not only the embedded energy of the of the solar panel, but it's the steel that supports it so that in a windstorm it doesn't blow away. It's the concrete that it's mounted in. Concrete has a massive carbon footprint. And if you don't take that into consideration, then you're sort of falsely giving a boost to a system that could be a lot more effective.
Yeah, and I think the transportation now is becoming a big deal for a lot of stuff. You know, you have something that's 50 pounds of transport versus a few ounces. The transportation costs, manufacturing costs, there's a whole pile of things you need to consider when you're looking at the total impact and the cost of installation and long, you know, what the life cycle.
And sometimes these things are not obvious. Like we can think of, oh, reducing the cost and keep sticking with solar for a second. It's like I think about like the cost of manufacturing the silicon itself. If you look at the total project cost, often on industrial size projects, solar panels are only half the cost. Well, where's the other half coming from? And then you start looking at what installation looks like. And that's affected by everything from regulation to how we decide to mount the panels. And I recently saw an interesting company whose innovation wasn't in the panels at all. It was that they just lay the panels all flat. They mount it on the ground. So they're not building any steel infrastructure and they put this on the dirt. And then they've made a little cleaning robot that goes by and cleans them every night.
Oh, I think I
And
saw that one.
so instead of focusing on making their panels more efficient and you know having the optimal angle to the sun or tracking the sun, having all of the systems that are expensive and prone to failure and need maintenance, they're like, how do we make the maintenance really easy and cheap? Because that will actually make the whole system more cost effective. And when you make the whole system more cost effective, then you can drive down the price of that energy.
And then sometimes you don't see that. So that's actually one of the things we're focusing on is that we don't need trackers. If you can do some of these ways, if you trap light, you can get the light in at any angle. It doesn't matter. Surfaces that are already there. So if you can wrap it around something, you don't have to build any new surfaces. Like putting on an electric vehicle, you don't have to get permits. You don't have to do a lot of the upfront costs that increase the cost of solar. If it's 25% of the panels and siting and permits and some of the other planning. But if you've got it on a vehicle, it's all just panel costs and how you install it and interface. So
That's a great point.
how you use it, I think one of the interesting things is instead of saying, hey, we can only put it here, let's look at where else can we put it so that it is cheaper and doesn't have those same costs. In our case, we're looking at there's already a battery associated with a car or electric bus.
Absolutely.
So it allows you to leverage those existing storage, and it's dedicated. I think there's a lot of, you know, smart people out there, and there's a lot of very interesting technologies. And I think what's really exciting, we need to invest in more of those. So part of it's the technologies and the support to those new opportunities for solving or mitigating climate change.
Yeah, and I think what came out of in this discussion as we talk about where do you put a solar panel so that you can reduce the cost is there's creativity to be had on addressing the climate crisis across the board. Like we talked about on the permitting front, we talked about on the structural front, we talked about on the robotic front, we talked about on the core technology side. We talked about like the list goes on and on, and there's so many ways to look at these problems and maybe change the framing. And in changing the framing, change the underlying economics. And I think that's one of the things that I'm excited to look out for in climate innovation is that it's in a lot of different spaces. And to having the boldness to just re-ask the question, the humility to say, maybe I don't know, maybe we could look at this a slightly different way. And that will unlock possibilities in reducing cost or increasing speed that we just hadn't thought of or seen before. And I love in your technology space how many downstream effects you can pick up on as you were discussing where you put it, the lightness, the angle that you can mount it on. And each of those then allows you to look at the world and your space in it and say, well, maybe we put solar panels on different things. Maybe we don't need it to convert any more fields or forests to renewable energy. It can be fully on the cityscapes that we already have. And I think that is an exciting imagining to me.
And I think, you know, the other thing is the progression of the internet. It's the concept itself. Nobody knew where it was going until you take that first step. And I think the same thing here. There's a lot of opportunities in renewable energy space. I think we're in this turning point. Climate change is forcing us to look at it more aggressively, but I think there's also looking at it from an investor standpoint. there's a lot of opportunity there. That means there are new things that are going to come out, and every new platform will mean whole new ideas and new ways to look and new types of economies that can be invested in, new opportunities out there. So I think a lot of people say, oh, this doom and gloom, but it's actually an opportunity that we have to create new markets, new jobs, new ways to expand the economy in a good way for the planet.
Yeah. So I think when people talk about investing, what they imagine is, this is a tool that I use and it makes me money. In reality, when you're investing, you are saying, as a group of people, you are saying, this is a belief I have about the future. This is how I imagine the future could be. And this is how I imagine the future could be better in particular. If you can't imagine it as better, you don't invest in whatever it is. And with like basic stuff, say you have a house, the bank gives you a loan because they imagine that you're going to be able to pay, you know, you'll have more money in the future to pay this house value with. And so they see that as a good investment. But similarly, when we invest in novel technologies or ways of doing things, or in our case, thematically, our portfolios are directed towards a world in which we solve climate change or move away from fossil fuels, we are imagining that world. And we're saying that's a pretty exciting world to live in. The one in which you have lots of micro distribution and production of power that is more in the control, in the hands of innovators and individuals, that is a pretty exciting world, a world in which we're using more electric transportation and that's powering our homes and keeping the air quality better. That's a more compelling world I want to live in. And so on the one hand, we can't imagine the doom and gloom, but when we invest, we are switching that. We are by necessity saying, this world is a more positive world. This economy is a better economy. This life is one that I want to live. And I'm going to put my dollars into making that happen. And then by doing that, those dollars are available for those people to build the technologies and that vision and enact that world. Then we manage, not to get too woo-woo about it, but that is the economic way of manifesting a new reality.
Right. And it allows more people to participate. It's kind of a democratization, allowing people to participate in it, even if they're maybe not a scientist or an engineer in these actual companies, but they're able to help with their dollars to say, hey, this is where we need to go. And I want to participate in it. And instead of just sticking in the bank, I'm actually make some money and help change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is why we started Carbon Collective. And I hope that it continues to allow people to do exactly that.
James, it has really been fascinating talking about the Carbon Collective and all of the nuances that go into energy, technology, and how people see it. To wrap up, could you give our listeners the big picture of what the Carbon Collective does?
Yeah, so thank you. Carbon Collective is an online-only investment and platform for the average individual who cares about fighting climate change and also wants to be investing their money in an intelligent way. So we allow you to set up a brokerage or a retirement account and have your money automatically invested in a diversified portfolio. So that means it's fairly stable market tracking, but it also fully divests you from fossil fuel companies. We use proxy voting to help pressure companies to move faster. And we invest you actively in the companies that are building climate change solutions. We also now offer 401k programs to companies. So if you're not invested individually and you know your company offers a 401k and you want to push them to have more climate forward options, it's a great way to help with a larger lever arm than just doing it yourself. Even if you don't want to invest with us, we have a whole bunch of resources on our website. If you go to carboncollective.co, you can find our ultimate guide to sustainable investing. You can find our full published list of what's in our portfolios and lots more besides. So if you just want to learn more about sustainable investing and our take on it and how we have imagined it, go to our website and snoop around.
Thanks for listening to today's Pi Energy podcast featuring James Regulinski, co-founder of the Carbon Collective. You can learn more about them or set up your portfolio today by visiting their website, carboncollective.co. If you want to learn more about Pi Energy, developing a new solar PV technology to expand where and how we use solar, check out our website at www.pienergy.com. Thanks for listening.